again, this is going to affect November, because what does Donald Trump do in response to this? He argues in favor of bringing the United States military into the streets, shooting protesters, you know, doing all of these authoritarian things that you expect to see in, you know, other countries other than the United States, that then provokes a lot of senior retired military officers to speak out about how bad an idea this is. We had this incident that you probably saw on June 1st, where in order to have a photo op in a church opposite the White House, he uses tear gas and you know, forced to clear the area of demonstrators. And, you know, the latest thing is all over the country, you know, Confederate statues are now being torn down. And, you know, Donald Trump ends up being the last defender of the Confederacy. I mean, it's just crazy, you know, just in his own self-interest. It's very hard to understand why he's doing this, because there's such a small minority of Americans right now that are on that side. And so it's like he sees that the ship is sinking and he wants to get further inside the ship so that, you know, he'll be sure to drown when the ship finally goes down.
Liberal Halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.
Velkommen til Civitas podcast Liberal Halvtime. Jeg heter Mathilde Fasting og dagens vert. Hver tirsdag og fredag denne sommeren publiserer vi Liberal Halvtime. På fredager så kan du høre Civitas-samtalen med kollega Eirik Løkke, og Civitas-samtalen finner du også som video på YouTube. Den kan du abonnere på YouTube. Du kan også rate oss i podcast-appen din som du bruker til å høre på Liberal Halvtime. I dag så har jeg med meg på nytt Francis Fukuyama fra San Francisco. Francis Fukuyama er gjest på det tradisjonsrike Solstrand-programmet for norske næringslivsledere utenfor Bergen, og han er med via link. Og i den forbindelse så har jeg snakket med ham om situasjonen i verden nå, om Kina, om hvordan koronakrisen påvirker oss, og hva som er viktig for ledere i alle sektorer av samfunnet å tenke på nå fremover. Dessuten så snakker han også om hva som skjer i USA, og om valget som blir veldig viktig i november. Så her kommer altså Francis Fukuyama fra Solstrand-programmet som podcast, i en samtale med meg, men foran et publikum som hadde oss på link. Episoden tatt opp onsdag 17. juni. Dere som lyttere får høre episoden nå. Velkommen til Francis Fukuyama.
I'd like to start with the COVID-19 pandemic, because last time Francis Fukuyama and I saw each other, we didn't really talk much about COVID-19, and that was in February this year. So how much hasn't the situation changed? We shook hands, and now we are connected by this Zoom, and we cannot even travel or fly or say hello or anything. So I'd like just to talk to you about the situation that we are experiencing right now. Will we ever come back to a situation that resembles the one that we had by New Year's Eve in 2019, you think?
No, I do think that we will eventually get back to a situation, something like what existed. You know, if a vaccine is developed or other effective ways of mitigating the disease, certain things in the economy, I think, will never quite go back to what they were, like air travel. And one thing I think that the crisis has taught us is that actually we can do things like hold meetings and lectures online. And I think that shift in education and other places will be permanent. But I think that there's a lot of geopolitical implications to the crisis that will have a longer lasting effect. It's turned out that most countries in Asia, not just China, but South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, Singapore, have all dealt more effectively with managing the epidemic than either a number of European countries or certainly than the United States. There's already been a geopolitical shift of the global economy towards East Asia, and I think that shift of power and influence is going to continue. Now, I know that you wanted to get into a discussion of this, so I'll just initiate it about what this means about global democracy. I think that if you look at the whole range of countries around the world, there's really not a strong correlation between how well you did in meeting the COVID crisis and whether you're a democracy or an authoritarian government, because in both categories, I think that there have been there's been a lot of variance. So China and Singapore have done pretty well. On the other hand, Russia, Turkmenistan, Belarus, I mean, there are plenty of authoritarian countries that have not had very good records in dealing with COVID. And similarly, in the democratic world, you have South Korea, Germany, your own country, Taiwan, that have actually, in fact, South Korea and Taiwan have better records than China in terms of controlling the disease, and they're both liberal democracies, whereas I think those liberal democracies, especially the ones that are being governed by populist leaders like the United States and Brazil, have terrible records. So there's something else that's going on other than whether you're democratic or authoritarian. The trouble is that there's a two-country comparison that everybody is looking at, which is the United States and China as representatives both of democracy and authoritarian government. And that comparison does not look good for democracy, because the Chinese have managed to control the epidemic much more effectively than the United States has. And so I think that's given us, a bit of a distorted view. But, you know, that's the view that people are going to take going forward. So I do think that this does not augur well for global democracy. I would say one more thing, that there are many countries around the world where you have leaders with authoritarian instincts that are using the crisis to expand executive power. The foremost example of this was obviously Viktor Orban in Hungary, who has voted emergency powers when the crisis started. And we'll have to see whether he's willing to give any of them back. But it's been true in the Philippines, in El Salvador, in China, in many other places. And that, I think, is something that will be a long-term change in the way that countries are governed around the world.
You can maybe expand a little on those three criteria that you mentioned in your article, first in the one that you had in the American Interest about the state capacity, for instance, and those two others.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, if you want to know why East Asia has done well, I think it really is a story of these three issues. So what is state capacity? You simply have to have a competent state that has the appropriate public health infrastructure, that has trained doctors and nurses and people managing the public health bureaucracy, that's able to enforce rules. Now, the enforcement part relates to the second criteria, which I think is trust. I think that you can't force people really to observe a quarantine past a certain point. You have to get voluntary compliance. And people are not going to comply if they don't trust the government. If they think that the government is self-interested or incompetent, there'll be constant violations of quarantines and so forth. So social trust is really important. And then the final issue is at the top, competent leadership. So in the United States and in Brazil, you had leaders that spent, I mean, in Brazil, he's still doing this. Bolsonaro is denying that, you know, this is even a serious epidemic. And obviously, under those conditions, you're not going to have a competent public health response. You had a similar version of that in the United States where February and March, really, Donald Trump spent all of his time denying that this was an important threat to the United States. And so it was really left up to state governors to formulate responses. So I think it's really those factors, rather than whether you're a democracy or an authoritarian government, that are probably better at explaining who responded well.
And there's also, of course, a question not only about how countries respond, but also about how international relations are going to be if we are looking at threats and maybe opportunities. But let's take threats first in a longer term perspective about this pandemic in the international relations context.
Well, obviously, a lot of international organizations that we've relied on have taken hits. A lot of that is simply because of the United States. I mean, the Trump administration just doesn't like international cooperation very much. And so this idea that you're going to pull out of the WHO and, you know, remove your funding in the middle of a pandemic is, you know, I think strikes everybody as really crazy. But nonetheless, you know, that's the administration's position. And that, you know, that is added to really almost 4 years now of attacks on other institutions like the World Trade Organization and NATO and so forth. So I think that, you know, American leadership has been important in creating these organizations and maintaining them. And that obviously is under threat. One interesting thing that's going on is that in response to this withdrawal of the United States, you know, other countries are beginning to realize that they're kind of on their own. And, you know, for example, there was a vaccine conference that was really initiated by the European Union a few weeks ago. And it was remarkable because the United States wasn't present at the conference, but there still was, you know, pledges of efforts, you know, to meet a common threat. But, you know, if you compare this to the crisis, the financial crisis in 2008, even though that response wasn't great, there was still a greater degree of solidarity among, let's say, the G8 or the G7 now, in terms of coordinated responses by central banks and so forth. You know, some of that has been going on behind the scenes, you know, with the U.S. Federal Reserve. But I would say in general, it shows that there's been this weakening of the international order, that, you know, that cooperation hasn't really been put front and center. And that's a real problem for us, I think, going forward.
Do you think we can turn that on to the relationship between the United States and China, and also the importance of the United States as a leader in, let's say, leader in liberal democracy and leader also in international mm-hmm. relations, and how important that is for the future?
Well, the U.S.-China relationship is complicated right now, and I think that it's hard to have a kind of dispassionate view of that because of the, you know, kind of anti-Chinese rhetoric that's been coming out of the Trump administration. I mean, quite frankly, I think they're doing this in order to deflect attention from their own mismanagement of the COVID crisis. But I think that the deterioration of relations really predates Trump. If you listen to the Democratic leadership like Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi in Congress, I think they're every bit as critical of China as Donald Trump has been. And so I think even had Hillary Clinton been president in this period, you would have seen probably, you know, a similar sort of decoupling of the United States and China. And, you know, I honestly think that this is really, this is the result of Chinese behavior. I wrote another article about, you know, yes, what kind of regime China has, and I think that there has not been an adequate reckoning with how different a country we're dealing with today than in 2013 when Xi Jinping first took power, because I think under previous leaders, China had been an authoritarian country, highly centralized. It was a dictatorship, but it was also a relatively liberal dictatorship that operated according to rules about retirement, about term limits, where the party and the government were still separated to, you know, a great extent. So if you were a university faculty in Beijing or Shanghai, you pretty much could decide what you would teach and what subjects you'd discuss and so forth. And individual Chinese people had a great deal of freedom, you know, to do things like criticize the government. And I think that's all different now. I think that we're dealing now with a leader that has a lot of nostalgia for Mao and Maoism, who's tried to turn back the clock on collective leadership, who's abolished a lot of those institutional constraints like term limits, and who has a very ambitious foreign policy that's really centered around the Belt and Road Initiative, but also, there's a real military component. And so the Chinese military continues to expand at a very fast rate. They've militarized large parts of the South China Sea. And so I think for all of those reasons, the high degree of dependence that Europe and the United States have developed on China as a source, you know, and we've now discovered that in medical supplies, you know, that dependence is really very, very high. And I think that is not a good situation. So I do think that there is a kind of necessary decoupling that is going on as supply chains are diversified to other places other than China. And I think that the cooling of relations will continue, you know, if Joe Biden is elected president in November, because it's based on these much more fundamental shifts, I think, in Chinese politics.
So we can just not let China go that easy. It's not easy, but it's also they seized the opportunity to intervene in Hong Kong just a couple of weeks ago. What do you think about the situation or the relationship between Hong Kong and the future of Hong Kong? And also you can include Taiwan, because we talked about that before as well in response to this Chinese intervention of their ruling system.
Well, you know, I was actually surprised last year that the Chinese didn't try to crack down on the protesters in Hong Kong, back then. And I think essentially what they're doing is using the COVID crisis as an excuse to do that while everyone else's attention is elsewhere. And so they've now passed a law that gives them the right to, you know, take security measures in Hong Kong unilaterally without consulting, you know, the local Hong Kong authorities. They've been arresting student leaders. And I think that what you're going to see is basically a walking back of the agreement from 1997, you know, about respecting China, Hong Kong's autonomy. In the case of Taiwan, again, I think people are excessively complacent about what's likely to happen there, including a lot of people in Taiwan itself. Xi Jinping in January of last year, in January of 2019, gave a speech in which he basically said that he expected that Taiwan would come back to China by the end of the decade, and that this would happen, if necessary, by military means. Now, I think that most people most business people, a lot of economists simply do not take seriously the possibility of actual military conflict taking place in East Asia. But I think that actually is unfortunately a reality, because the military balance there has been shifting quite rapidly. If China had tried to retake Taiwan by force, 10 years ago, it would have been very, very difficult. Today, it's much less difficult for them to do that. And Xi Jinping said it, and I think we ought to take him seriously. So I think that both of those regions, Hong Kong and Taiwan, are under great threat today. And, it's very difficult to know what to do about it, because ultimately it's a matter of power, and the relative power balance in those areas, is very much shifted towards China.
So doing business in those areas, you would, I don't expect you to give any advice on that, but how do you think business life and economic life will be for Western companies going into, or stay, they are now in Hong Kong and Taiwan, what should they think about, what should they do, and what should they expect?
Well, you know, there's a larger question of how Western businesses ought to deal with China as a whole and not just in those two territories.
Let's include China then.
You know, both of the, well, Taiwan has been a completely independent country, and so it's in a different category. Hong Kong has been used as a gateway because there's more freedom or typically there's been more freedom, and there's a real legal system in Hong Kong, which is why many, you know, Western companies headquarter their operations in Hong Kong rather than in mainland China. You know, I'll frankly say that I think a lot of European businesses and leaders, political leaders, have been really naive about China and continue to think that they're still dealing with a China from the 1990s or the early 2000s, when I think the country has really changed in many ways. If you listen to Jörg Wuttke, who is the head of the kind of the European Business Council in Beijing, he's a longtime China watcher, and hear him talk about, you know, the way that the Chinese have behaved towards European businesses, it's very similar to what's happened with Western businesses. There's been a huge amount of theft of intellectual property, failure to respect earlier agreements regarding, you know, property rights of Western companies in China. And I think it means that, you know, over time, it's going to be necessary to, you know, have a lot of European companies as well disengage. This is all centered around this controversy over Huawei. And this kind of illustrates the problem we're having right now with the American administration, because, you know, they've targeted Huawei, I think, in a very clumsy way. I think actually that it is really crazy for any Western democracy to allow Huawei to build your 5G infrastructure, because it's not because, you know, the company originated in the People's Liberation Army. That doesn't matter. I mean, the problem is that there really is no truly independent private sector anywhere in China. By statute, the Chinese Communist Party can tell any one of these companies what to do. And it means that ultimately, if your telecoms infrastructure has been built by Huawei, you know, the Chinese government is going to be able to manipulate it in the future if there's a crisis or there's a showdown over you know, some political issue. And I think it's actually kind of ridiculous that Western democracies allowed that capacity to build that infrastructure to slip away. So right now, Ericsson is really the only alternative, and it can't really provide the same kinds of services that Huawei can. And I think it's really important that we build that up. Now, what's unfortunate about the way that the Trump administration has handled this is that if you face a threat like this, presumably what you want to do is build a coalition of other democracies that are similarly being threatened by this kind of Chinese activity and coordinate. And instead they attacked, you know, Europeans, and they threatened trade sanctions against them simultaneously. And it's interesting, you know, the British government actually just shifted its position, Boris Johnson's government, about a month ago, where they had agreed to let Huawei build a certain amount of their infrastructure, and now they've kind of rescinded that decision. And they've started to do what I think the U.S. should have done, you know, several years ago, which is actually to try to build a European coalition of countries that could coordinate on their telecoms infrastructure policy. But unfortunately, you know, the United States has been completely missing from this, you know, from this debate. So, you know, it's now up to other countries to fill in that vacuum.
So let's turn to the United States. I know that in 2016 you said that you were horrified when Trump was elected, but you were kind of interested as a political scientist in seeing what happened to the institutions. And I must admit that I have defended you, and I said that, okay, I think that you might not be that thrilled about those institutions either right now, because we are 4 years into his term, almost 3.5 years, and there's an election coming. And we discussed the two other candidates in February, and now we didn't know about Biden then, because it was Warren and Sanders we talked about, and now it's Biden. So can you tell us a little bit about the situation in the US right now, also with the racist demonstrations that's going on, and what will happen between now and November?
Well, every indication, points to Trump losing, and actually losing by a pretty substantial margin. And that's really because of several obvious things that have happened. So the first is the COVID crisis and his handling of it, which has been, I think, pretty incompetent. The second has to do with the economy. Because of the crisis, we've gone into a very deep recession. And I think it's pretty clear that we're not going to be pulling out of it very rapidly anytime soon. The next thing is the fact that the Democrats did not pick one of their far-left candidates, but rather pick Joe Biden, who I think by far is the most trusted and electable candidate. And they did this early. Another factor really has to do with the racial crisis that we're experiencing now in the United States. It may be hard to convey this, the amount of anger that was stimulated by the George Floyd killing. I mean, I've spent the last 2 weeks dealing with my own students who are, angry at me because they didn't think I was doing enough, about this just in our little graduate program. But this has been going on in every single university all over the United States, in every single city. The number of protests about police violence is just, it's really unprecedented. I mean, we haven't seen anything like this since the killing of Martin Luther King in 1968. So there's this gigantic mobilization on the left. And I think that's going to change the character of American politics, down the road. And again, this is going to affect November, because what does Donald Trump do in response to this? He argues in favor of bringing the United States military into the streets, shooting protesters, doing all of these authoritarian things that you expect to see in, other countries other than the United States, that then provokes a lot of senior of retired military officers to speak out about how bad an idea this is. We had this incident that you probably saw on June 1st, where in order to have a photo op in a church opposite the White House, he uses tear gas and forced to clear the area of demonstrators. The latest thing is all over the country, Confederate statues are now being torn down. And Donald Trump ends up being the last defender of the Confederacy. I mean, it's just crazy, just in his own self-interest. It's very hard to understand why he's doing this, because there's such a small minority of Americans right now that are on that side. And so it's like he sees that the ship is sinking and he wants to get further inside the ship so that, he'll be sure to drown when the ship finally goes down.
So if he's not reelected and if Biden wins, do you think it will change the U.S.?
Well, there are certain things that presidents can do on their own authority. So I think in terms of international relations and foreign policy, there'll be a number of immediate shifts. I think that the questioning of NATO and of other American alliances that Trump is engaged in will be reversed right away. One of the strangest things that And the most troubling things that Trump has done is this love affair with Putin and Russia. Right. So even just last month, he starts suggesting that if the G8, first of all, the G7, if it meets again, we should invite Putin to this. Right. That nobody else in the G7 thinks this is a good idea, but, you know, Trump does. And so that kind of thing will cease. I think that, you know, what Biden is able to do will depend a lot on what happens in Congress, so that if the Democrats win back the Senate, which right now it looks like they've got a reasonable chance of doing, then they'll be able to actually shift domestic policy in certain important areas. I mean, I personally think that healthcare is, you know, is number one on the list, because this crisis has indicated how big the economic and racial and ethnic disparities are in the way that Americans get health care. And that's something that really needs to be fixed very quickly. But the problem, I think, goes a little bit deeper than just this one person, Donald Trump, because, you know, what I find the most disturbing about American politics right now is that one third of Americans that don't just approve of him, but they love him, right? You'll see this on Saturday. He's going to hold a big rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and, you know, you'll see a stadium full of people that are not doing social distancing, you know, that are going to go crazy, you know, because they're going to be able to see Donald Trump in person. And that's, you know, a kind of sign of a longer term problem in American society, which is this really deep polarization. And unfortunately, that polarization, I think, is going to continue even if the Democrats return to power in November.
So how much do you think these things, both in China and in the US and international relations and all those, this global picture, will inflict Norwegians, and especially the people sitting here in the audience, I mean, business leaders, how concerned should they be about the international situation right now?
Well, I think that it's a very troubling time, because a lot of the forces that stabilized international relations, like international institutions and like, you know, the voluntary cooperation between democracies, has eroded. And I think that, you know, for many democracies that have been relying on the United States, the past few years have been very troubling. And I think the level of distrust has gotten very great. So even if you get a Democratic president that wants to restore these relationships to what they were before 2016, you know, there are going to be a lot of people that will be skeptical about whether this is really going to happen, or how, you know, whether they can continue to count on the United States in the future. You know, just to take an example, even if you have a landslide election, what typically tends to happen 2 years later is that the other party comes back into power, because people are just disappointed with, you know, the kinds of changes that come about. And that may happen in the United States in, you know, 2022. So I think there's going to be a lot of reluctance to simply go back to trusting the United States and relying on it. Now, some of that is not a bad thing, because I think that, you know, that dependence has not always been healthy. And I think other democracies ought to make, you know, their own arrangements, and they ought to, you know, work on cooperative arrangements among themselves to deal with those kinds of contingencies. But I do think that it is going to affect, you know, a country like Norway, because you're right in the middle of a lot of these issues, you know, about climate change, about dealing with Russia, about, you know, quite a number of things.
So before we round up, I have a few more questions and we'll let the audience in. But since you're talking about what other democracies can do, we haven't been talking about the European Union and the European democracies. So maybe you could just share your thoughts on Europe and the responses to COVID, and also in response to these questions.
Well, you know, I think the COVID crisis revealed the same split In Europe that the financial crisis or the euro crisis did, basically between Northern and Southern Europe, where Northern Europe, especially Germany, was not willing to subsidize weaknesses in Southern Europe. And I think, you know, we could get into a long discussion about the response to the euro crisis, but I don't think that that was a correct position. And, you know, there's some signs that this time some lessons have been learned from that, because, you know, there was this agreement that Europe as a whole would back these euro bonds that would then, you know, be the responsibility of the EU or the eurozone as a whole. And I think that's a good idea. But in addition to the north-south split, you now have a pretty big east-west split as well, because you have a number of new members of the European Union, like Hungary and Poland, and then some would-be members like Serbia that are going off in a, you know, in a much more authoritarian direction. And, you know, it's not my place to say, because I'm not a European, but, you know, if I were a European, I would have taken much stronger measures to prevent that from happening. I mean, Hungary has been getting something like 5% of its GDP in the form of EU subsidies, and that's strengthened Viktor Orban's hand. And I think that, you know, there are mechanisms that could be brought to bear to, you know, just indicate to some of these newer members that there are certain democratic standards that they have to meet if they want to be full-fledged members of the EU. So in that respect, you know, so there's some hopeful signs, but I think that there's going to be a lot of tensions, you know, along these multiple fracture lines.
And finally, I was asked by a journalist the other day if you had any unthinkable thoughts, like the unification of Germany that you had many years ago, and if you have them today. And I answered that I just had to ask you. I had some suggestions, but I have to ask you now, what are your unthinkable thoughts?
Well, you know, there's some deeper questions about the nature of liberal societies that I think I'm much more aware of now than I was previously. I mean, one of them has to do with just the kind of internal contradiction in liberalism that, you know, liberalism is based on tolerance and openness to multiple, you know, viewpoints, lifestyles, and the like. But I think one of the things that begins to happen in liberal societies is that because society itself doesn't always agree with, you know, that formula, you get a lot of pressure to actually make people agree. And so in order to enforce liberalism, a lot of liberal societies then start becoming increasingly illiberal. And we've seen this in, you know, a lot of cases. I mean, we've got these tensions now between religious conservatives that don't like gay marriage, and now, you know, they're forced to, you know, if you're there's a Supreme Court case involving a bakery that didn't want to bake a wedding cake for a gay couple, and now the state is forcing them to do that. And, you know, this is something that didn't seem problematic in earlier years when the issue had to do with race and whether stores had to serve black customers and so forth. But I think that as time goes on, there are more and more of these social issues that then become very divisive, where state powers, you know, being used to enforce a liberal order that increasingly looks illiberal. This has come up in a lot of university campuses with restrictions on free speech, for example, that there are certain things that you're not allowed to say because, you know, they're offensive to the dignity of different groups and so forth. And so thinking this through in theory, I think, is actually something that we haven't adequately done. And, you know, it's a discussion, I think, that will be with us for some time to come.
I guess you're quite curious in knowing what I suggested that you were thinking, but I'll tell you, it was that you were thinking maybe that we in the future will get a federal Europe, or that the European Union will become more federal. And the other thing was that Biden will become president and the United States will come back on its feet again. So I was trying the optimistic way. Okay, thanks a lot.
Tusen takk til lytterne for at dere hørte på dagens episode fra Solstrand-seminaret og Francis Fukuyama. Hvis du liker Liberal Halvtime, så gjentar jeg at du kan abonnere på sendingene våre I appen din og gi oss tilbakemeldinger eller tipse andre. Og vil du holde deg oppdatert om hva vi gjør I Civita også nå I sommer, så kan du abonnere på nyhetsbrevet vårt. Gå inn på civita.no, legg inn navn og e-post. Takk for I dag, og velkommen tilbake.
Liberal Halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.
Moderne media.